That's my way of saying, let the party begin. Yeah? I'll take questions, guys. Yes.
Okay, I have just read this novel, and I really admire it. And I know you prefer a story, but I do have one question, and that is, are your novels sold in Nigeria?
Yes. Yes. The government is concerned about my journalism, my weekly columns. Government officials don't have the inclination or perhaps the ability to read novels. So they don't worry how, you know, of course in the novel, you know, you see a lot of, you see some corruption, right? But they're not concerned about that. They're concerned about my weekly columns where I, of course, address them directly. When you write about corruption in a novel, you have to write it in a different kind of, you have to adopt a different kind of guise, see. You don't, otherwise, you know, it becomes a novel that sort of preaches, you know. In fact, a Nigerian guy who follows my my columns came to a reading in DC and accused me of changing my tone. He said, oh, you know, you write in a very stinging way about corruption in your columns, but in the novel, you know, you are playing about it. I said, look, this is a novel. A reader will not take you just saying to them, these people are corrupt. This is what they've done. I said, then it becomes something different. I said, when you expose, like the local government chairman who has a huge mansion and builds a small house, small structure, and puts a black and white TV for the villagers to go and watch, you know, old NBA games, and he says, I've given them the dividends of democracy. That tells you everything. This man has stolen the people's money, he's built himself a mansion, and then he gives them, you know, something tiny. That's how a novel functions. But, you know, he didn't get it. He thought that I would just pound politicians the same way I do in my columns, and, you know, yeah. Yeah, so the novel is sold in Nigeria. Yeah. Thank you. Yes.
Just a quick answer to a very huge question.
Yes.
Yes. But so all kinds of stories, of course, right now are coming out of Nigeria.
Yeah.
You have an election coming up.
An election that was postponed. Election was to hold this Saturday, but the president, the incumbent president, who is extremely unpopular and will lose the elections. There's a man who has let the Islamist group, a terrorist group, Boko Haram, run roughshod over the northeast part of Nigeria, you know, just putting the soldiers on the run out of corruption, because the Nigerian army has the capacity to defeat this ragtag group. But the military has been out of power after Nigeria was ruled by the military for many, many years. And so the military were the ones who were stealing billions. Suddenly the politicians are there stealing the billions. And so the military is not in a hurry for the war to end, because as long as they say that this group is a threat, then the military budget continues to rise. And military generals and so on have a way of stealing their own funds. So the man is supposed to lose. But the military is loyal to him, as the man who will win against him is a retired military officer who will not take nonsense from the military, who will ask for accountability. So the military forces got together and told the Electoral Commission, if you hold the elections this Saturday as scheduled, we can't guarantee any security. So the Electoral Commission was forced to postpone the elections for 6 weeks to give the president and the ruling party maybe more time to look for ways to rig it. But I don't think they can rig it this time around. The groundswell of opposition is just overwhelming in the country.
Second part of my question.
Yeah.
I recall I read somewhere who basically said that U.S. intervention in Nigeria is part of the problem at the moment, and concerning, of course, what we're always after everywhere, which is oil, right? So how much do you figure that into the equation of the halt in Nigeria?
U.S. intervention.
Yeah.
Well, about 15 years ago, the U.S. intelligence analyst said that 2015 is likely to be the year that Nigeria will fracture and just fall to pieces. And so that has haunted Nigerians. And for a lot of Nigerians, because Nigeria is a nation which is very strange. It's a nation that doesn't have a lot of citizens. who believe in it. So there are a lot of enclaves, you know. So you have the Christian enclave, you have the Muslim enclave, you have the Nigeria has 400 plus different ethnic groups, and every ethnic group is making its own claims, right? So it's a very chaotic, very, very incohesive space. And for some of us, very deeply painful, you know. So the fact that America has projected that this could be the year Nigeria falls apart is at the back of everybody's mind, because this is the perfect recipe for disaster. Nigeria is now sundered along religious lines. The incumbent president is a Christian. The man who is certain to beat him in an election is a Muslim. And so the incumbent president has been playing the Christian part, to rally Christians behind him, even though nothing that he does is really Christian, in my view. But he has a vice president who is a Muslim. So as he's saying, you know, Christians lying behind me, his vice president is also saying, we are more Muslim than the guy who beat us. So, you know, he's really not a good Muslim. So the exploitation of religion is absolutely dangerous. The exploitation of ethnic sentiments. You know, so there are people who say this retired general is likely to be better, even though my position is I've written that it should be neither the incumbent president nor the general, you know, who is like an 18th century person, but with self-discipline. That he left office, he used to be a military head of state, left office and didn't have a home, okay? When Nigerians leave office, they become billionaires in dollars, right? So this man is disciplined. But I say it takes more than discipline to bring a country to where it needs to be. So the U.S. government refused to sell weaponry to Nigeria. Nigeria wanted to purchase weapons. But the U.S. government said that Nigerian army was committing extrajudicial executions. The current phase of the fight with Boko Haram really started in July of 2009, when some military people had a conflict with members of this group, you know, which was led by a charismatic man, Yusuf Mohammed. And there was some shooting. The military captured Yusuf Mohammed, tied his hands behind his back, showed him at a press conference as they handed him to the police. 2 hours later, the police, you know, showed his dead body, bullet riddled, and said that the man died in an exchange of gunfire. A man, you know, so, and it's typical Nigerian government response to things, you know. Oh, if we kill this guy, then his followers will just be scared and they will just disperse. The opposite became true. That the man was always telling his followers that the Nigerian government was inherently corrupt and decadent, and that it had to do with Western education. So his critique is that Western education was their enemy. And so he called for a return to Islamist fundamentalism as the answer, which is a wrong prescription. But when the government killed him, thinking, oh, we're going to address this by brutally murdering the man, his followers then say, wow, that's true. Because the man was caught, it is Western education that mandated that he be killed. So they became radicalized and began to took to suicide bombing and planting bombs in public places and so on, and have received arms from the mess in Libya. You know, and I've captured so much weaponry from the Nigerian army by sacking so many barracks of the Nigerian army, slaughtering soldiers, and so on and so forth. So, the American government refused to sell weaponry to the Nigerian government, because the Nigerian soldiers have been seen where they round up people that they're suspected to be Boko Haram members. They'll ask them to lie down and shoot them from behind as they're lying. And this all over the internet. So the U.S. government said, we can't be complicit in this. So the Nigerian government is then saying, okay, the U.S. is sponsoring, is interested in the fracturing of Nigeria, because their analysts predicted Nigeria is going to fall apart in 2015. They're refusing to give us weapons to fight against Boko Haram. So they are indirectly invested in this. The U.S. could do more. should have done more, you know, some years ago. You know, the U.S. coddled corrupt governments in Nigeria, allowed corrupt government officials to bring in their loot to this country and buy our property and, you know, maintain huge bank accounts and so on. The British, for example, did a better job of stopping such, you know, money laundering and so on. And there's a governor, former governor in Nigeria, who is spending 13 years in jail in Britain. There isn't, what the U.S. does is that they stop them from, they revoke their visas to you know, from coming to this country. Yeah. Yes.
Years ago when I was a young undergraduate, I had an opportunity to interview Achebe and James Baldwin for the
Georgia, yeah. Oh my gosh.
And I got actually to spend a weekend with him because Black Scholar had sent me to interview him.
Yes.
And Achebe said when he writes, his wife would always get sad because he disappears into the house next door and he's gone. And I was thinking about that along with Alice Walker's once said to me, Dorothy, your problem is getting your novel finished is you keep having kids.
Yeah.
You got to do one or the other. And she said when she writes the whole book out and then goes back and edit. And that academics tend to correct as they go along. And so it's never finished. So for a couple of my students here who are writers and can you talk a little bit about your process? Do you just go and do it all in one go, or do you stop and work and go back?
Let me first of all respond to Alice Walker. Children are not the enemies of literature. It's such a terrible thing to say, and you know she has a terrible relationship with her daughter. You know, who wrote a very savage piece about her, you know, so who knows? It's not for me as a writer, I want to be present to my family. I want to be present to my wife, because in the end, that's what counts. You know, all the accolade that you get as a writer will come to naught if your children look back and say, you know, we didn't really know our father, he didn't care. So I want to be a good parent first, because that's what my parents gave me, and it's so important that I give it to my family, my wife, and my children. So I want to be even better than a great writer. I want to be a great father and husband, you know? Yeah. But then talking about my process, I said that I never sleep. I hardly ever sleep or go to bed with a sentence and wake up in the morning still loving it as I did at the moment of his initial composition. And so what I do, which is maddening for me, I would like to break that habit. I would like to write through and then go and, But whenever I sit down to write, I invariably check what I'd done yesterday. And so my moments, my sessions produce very little new writing. It produces a lot of reshaping, which is why I say I couldn't write quickly, right? I go and reshape. And there are different ways. You know, Nadine Gardimer, as a writer, once said that before she writes a book, that she lets the book gestate in her mind for years, you know, and that she understands all her characters and all her settings and situations and knows where they're going to be. And she says, therefore, when she sits down to write it, it becomes almost a process of transcription, you know. And so sometimes she writes a novel within a month, but it's lived in her head for years. Reminded me again of Gebre Gasha Makers, see, who did an interview, I suspect, years ago in Playboy. I used to read Playboy magazine for the interviews. Guys, interviews. Playboy used to carry the best interviews, right? Jeff? Oh, because he's the kind of guy who would know, you know.
So he must have been keeping it from
You have a lot of explaining to do tonight, Jeff. Yeah, yeah. But you know, I like putting people in trouble because people put me in trouble. But years ago, I don't know if it is this, but years ago, the Playboy magazine used to interview people like Marquez, writers, great literary figures. I mean, now I think they'll go for Brad Pitt and so on. You know, so I stopped reading. But Marquez said somewhere, when he has an idea for a novel, because it's a painful process. It's a process that mandates a kind of solitary existence. You know, you write, even when you write in the presence of people, there is, you are not present to them, right? You are consumed by the process. So it happens to me, you know. when I was writing my first novel, my wife would tell me, oh, these friends of ours have invited us to dinner. And I'll say, okay. Then the day of the dinner, she would say, okay, you got to get ready. I say, where? She says, you know, to the dinner. I say, how come you didn't tell me about it? And she would say, but I told you. I said, no, you didn't. And I meant it. I didn't hear it. So when I was saying yes, it was, there's some noise buzzing. And I think yes is the answer that will get this noise out of the way. So I say yes, right? So Marquez said that when he has an idea for a new book, that he does everything. He's desperate not to begin. So he says he takes long vacations with his wife, Mercedes, goes to cafes and just sits all day, you know, yawning with his friends. But he says that after a while, there's a kind of momentum, a kind of force that the story takes on. And he says it's as if the story gathers him and plucks him down on his desk. And he says he writes furiously until he's done. And that when he's finished, he feels there's a hole in his head where the story had lived. See, so my process is one of revising as I do it, I could produce a lot more if I had the discipline to leave a structural problem. You know, for example, if I come to a moment of structural blockage. I will wait for months until I figure it out. And usually you figure it out where? Where do the spirits send you help? When you're in the shower, precisely. Now, two moments. You know, when you're in the shower, suddenly the answer comes. Whoa, this is the way to get around this, what I thought was a blockage, right? The other time when they come is that moment when you're very tired and you're about to drift off to sleep. And the answer comes. And then you repeat it to yourself 20 times and you say, I'm going to remember in the morning. In the morning, you don't remember. Yeah. So you know, I simply can't move beyond that. So even when I know what's going to come after, I wait if there is some kind of blockage. I simply don't have the habit or the disposition. But that's me. There are writers who say, okay, this is not working because I know a different scene that it's clear to me, so let me go write that and wait. For me, it has to be sequentially fluid and fluent before I continue. Yeah? I want a question from a student. I insist on it. I'm insisting. I'm begging you. Let's okay? One student? Yes. Oh, thank you for saving the day.
Well, I was going to ask a question, but so you're telling us the second story when you said when you became a fiction writer, and when he asked you if you wrote a novel, and you said
yes,
and you didn't. Did you actually produce any work of fiction before then? Or
No. I had not produced a work of fiction before. Yeah. So this was an introduction to, and what it tells me, because it informs my pedagogy, really, as a teacher. I tell students, especially in my creative writing classes, that part of what I want to do is to enable them to unleash what they know, but didn't know that they knew, right? Because I knew how to write a novel, but I didn't know I knew that. So when I said, yes, I'm working on a novel, he says, get it for me. I thought it was my life was going to fall flat. I was thinking of maybe evading him, you know, for some time, maybe taking off to Boston where I had a cousin and say, you know, something came up and I left town. But I started writing and the thing was coming out and coming out. So I ended up writing 20 something pages. And I gave it to him and I said, "What? Okay, this is great." And it's, you know, I mean, such things are important, you know, so the almost the functioning of serendipity in our creative, the development of our creative faculty, you know, so that's something that came to me, And, oh, by the way, and Ngugi wa Thiong'o, we're talking about Ngugi. So in 2010, I was in Nairobi for a literary festival, and here was Ngugi. So I told the story of this serendipitous moment of my writing. So Ngugi said that as a student at Makerere University, that he did had the same similar experience. He went to the cafeteria and ran into the student who was the editor of the university's literary magazine that published short stories and you know poetry and so on. This guy, he said, was like a star on campus because those were the days when distance mattered a lot. There were very few such journals in Africa. And so this man, even though he was a student, he said he had great star power. So Ngugi said he went up to the man and, you know, didn't know what to say. So he said to the man, "I've written a short story and I'd like to show it to you." And he thought that the man would say, no, we want stories from it. Because this magazine was publishing stories by established writers like Achebe and so on. So I thought the guy would dismiss him. And the guy said, "Yeah, let me have it, bring it to me." And Ngugi said he'd never written a line of anything. But he went back and started writing a short story and submitted it. It became his very first short story ever. And he gave me a collection where that story appears. Mm. So the moral of the story, guys, is lie like hell. But follow it up. Yeah? Yeah, back it up, back it up. Yeah? Yeah. Yes.
I was just going to ask, like, if you had any advice for writers, let's say, like, for me personally, like, I'll be inspired and I'll write for hours, so, like, I can't write anymore. I need to, like, get some sleep.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'll wake up in the morning and try to get back to where I was.
Mm-hmm.
And I, like, can't get back into that.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's such a thing as feeling that great momentum, that great having it, being in the zone, they call it in basketball, where somebody who has missed 5 shots suddenly makes 10 in a row, right? So it happens in writing. You start writing and it could be a phrase that comes your way. And these things happen in very, you know, interesting ways. Part of it is mysterious. It comes and you say, whoa. Or a scene becomes so vivid to you that you just write and write and you don't want to go to bed, right? But then the next day, it becomes work. You have to work for it for a living, okay? So a writer knows how to balance these two things, to write when you are not inspired, but to just, you know, so some writers say, I must write a certain number of words every day. And if nothing comes, I'll stay there in front of the typewriter or the computer until I produce that number. I must write a certain length of time. So if it is 2 or 3 hours, you say, okay, if nothing comes, you just stare at this computer for 2 or 3 hours. So invariably you start writing. So to sort of find a way to integrate those moments when the inspiration is there and is gushing, and moments when you have to work at it. You have to sweat blood a bit, you know. But just make writing so important that it's almost as if your life depended on it. And if your life depends on something, you do it, whichever way you can, but you do it. Thank you. Thank you, guys. Thank you. You've been very, very, very. Thank you. So I'll sign books.